Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
The government's response to the coronavirus pandemic has been hit with a double blow following a hitch in its attempt to roll out the AstraZeneca vaccine and fresh concerns emerging about the Johnson & Johnson one. Now, separately, it's been scrambling to increase capacity in the hotel quarantine system, with bookings now halted ahead of even more countries being added to the mandatory list from tomorrow. So can the vaccine programme be altered to keep the rollout on track? And what will the economic impact be if it is? Well, in a moment, I'll be joined by Dr. Cliona Ní Chealaigh, consultant in infectious diseases at St. James's Hospital, and also Danny McCoy, chief executive of IBEC. But first, our reporter Barry Lenehan has been on the streets this morning to find out how people feel about this latest blow to the vaccine rollout.
We only had a discussion this morning about it, and I said whatever hope we had of getting the vaccine this side of the summer, I actually feel that it could be this time next year. With everything going on, maybe not this time next year, but certainly into the new year. We're obviously at the younger side of things. So it's very unfortunate. Very, very unfortunate.
Taoiseach, the government, they still think they can keep it on track. You don't believe that?
Absolutely not. 100%. No. I don't know how they could keep it on track. If we haven't got the vaccine supply there, how can they keep it on track? They haven't met what they've promised us so far, unfortunately, so I can't see it happen. Yeah. I only said this morning I would, if I was offered any vaccine this morning, I would take it. I think the risks are too low.
I have no idea when I'm going to get the vaccine. I am nearly 60 myself. It's up and down. I don't know where we're going with this.
They say it'll be before the summer, by the end of June. Do you believe that? Do you have confidence in it?
I've decided not to to build up any hopes, just to play it as by ear and see what happens. I just think being confident leads to disappointment.
Would you have any preference on the vaccine, which supplier you would take?
Yeah, I'd prefer not to get a clot, so I'm losing confidence in the two brands that seem to be associated with that.
Hopefully June, July. You know, with all drugs, there is some element of risk, so I'd like to see a balanced approach to the reporting as well on, you know, versus the sample rate. Right now, I'd be taking what was offered.
What about the summer? Are you confident that the summer reopening will happen as planned, perhaps?
Really depends on what the strategy of the government is. I still think there's probably a more aggressive plan needed in terms of the vaccinations. I think we've probably been held up by the procurement element in Europe and also our project management of the rollout. I think there's probably more to do.
I suppose there's always going to be risks and stuff with these things. I think for me it's still quite minimal. There's risks with every type of, I suppose, drug and stuff that's out there.
Given developments, the government is steadfast to 80% will have one jab by the end of June. Do you have confidence in those figures?
I wouldn't say I have. I'd say I'm probably 80-85% confident. I think, look, you know, we just need to trust now that hopefully things are starting to go to plan. But yeah, I suppose it doesn't bode much confidence what's happened.
I mean, all vaccines have a risk. I mean, if you get tablets from the chemist and look at them, there's all the issues that you could have. I think the Minister for Health has a very, very difficult job. He was thrown in at the deep end. But I think he's doing a good job, you know. I think it's overall, they've done a good job, you know.
That's people out and about today talking to Barry Lenehan, and I was struck there, one man saying being confident leads to disappointment, and you'd wonder whether that's a sentiment being repeated in government this morning. Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times, joins me on the line now. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Claire.
Really is another fine mess we're in today. Will we deal first of all with the hotel quarantine situation? Some people might be confused about the notion that there would be walk-ins at a time when everyone is having to pre-book accommodation. Will you just explain to us what's going on?
So, indeed, it is. It's a little confusing because the airlines, and Stephen Donnelly was making this point last night, they are under the regs supposed to be checking people as they get on the plane and making sure that if they're coming from a country that is on the Schedule 2 list, that they have a booking in the mandatory hotel quarantine system. Now, the Department of Transport put out a statement last night making an interesting point, which was that unless the plane is coming from, on a direct flight, one of these countries on Schedule 2, it can be difficult for the staff on board the plane to actually identify someone who has a travel history associated with one of those countries. So the first time that might actually come to light would be after they fill in the passenger locator form, and presumably as they're coming through customs. Only then and there does it become apparent that they have to go into mandatory hotel quarantine. And that then becomes quite a difficult and tricky legal proposition, because they're in a situation whereby they're in the state without a booking. We're saying that, you know, it's legally a legal necessity for them to go into the hotel, but there then has to be a place for them in the hotel system for them to comply with that legal obligation. So I think that's what's at the root of this problem, that there was more people coming in through this gateway than had been anticipated. There's around an average of about 12 a day coming in up until last Friday. I understand that ticked up a little bit more over the weekend. So effectively, there has to be a kind of prioritization for those people coming in without a booking. And the people that is really impacting on are those who wanted to book and come in, where there's now a de facto cap on those arrivals.
But it's not as though we don't have thousands of empty hotel rooms around the country. Even TIFCO, the company that is managing all of this for the government, they have the 4 quarantine hotels. They also have 20 other hotels.
They do, and my understanding is that eventually, under the kind of broader envelope of the deal that was struck between TIFCO and the Department of Health, they may expand into those other hotels. But like, the very pressing and pertinent and real question here is why there wasn't more capacity squared away earlier on. I mean, we know there were 650 rooms across those hotels. That's rising to in the region of 900 by the 19th, and then to 1100, I think it is, by the 26th. But like, it wouldn't have taken massively sophisticated mathematical modelling to project that, you know, between walk-ins and a certain percentage that has to be put aside for people who test positive for COVID, that they might have hit that capacity sooner rather than later. The fact they've hit it before the presumed surge that's going to be associated with the addition of countries like the USA, Italy and France to the list on Thursday, I think is doubly unsettling and raises more profound questions about, you know, how deep the planning is associated with it, and, you know, just how much capacity can be brought on scheme, how quickly, and you know, whether we will be back here again if the numbers don't collapse coming in from those countries.
I'm reading today in your own paper, and indeed in others, that there is a lot of concern at government level about the twists in the vaccine rollout, the issues that have emerged with both AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. And I see in the last little while, RT News, Samantha Librari is reporting there that the Minister for Health is saying that consideration will be given now to spacing out doses of the Pfizer vaccine beyond 4 weeks. So what other methods or what other plans are being looked at in order to address these hitches and problems with the rollout?
I think there's a limited kind of suite of options available to Ireland, you know, because a lot of the regulatory power is devolved away from us to the European Medicines Agency, and a lot of the supply chain stuff is out of our hands as well. So one of the few levers that we have available to us is spacing out that dosing schedule. And that is something that I think will be looked at. It could only be done on advice from the National Immunization Advisory Committee, NIAC. So that is a process that would have to be gone through. Other things that could be looked at would be potentially mixing different brands of vaccine, or, you know, ramping up the rollout to the 60 to 69s, trying to get that AstraZeneca into those arms as quickly as possible. And that's something that we've seen probably this morning with the opening up of the online portal for bookings. I mean, it remains to be seen whether NIAC would give approval to one or all of those strategies. They are things that they looked at before and effectively turned down. They have more data now and the situation is more pressing. And indeed, I think they will be facing some political pressure as well to keep momentum in the vaccination program, because so much relies on it. I mean, we saw the economic forecasts that are likely to come out today around the rate of growth that can be expected in the economy and the jobs rebound that can be expected. Mm-hmm. But all that is contingent on vaccination. And so is a better life during the summer. You know, the kind of projections that we saw about the kind of activities that were done under the modelling by NEFIT. Again, it's all contingent on the vaccine rollout. So much hangs on this, and
absolutely,
so much hangs on that momentum in it.
It's one of the key metrics. Jack, thank you very much for joining us. Jack Horgan-Jones. And you might have heard that Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, confirmed this morning that the HSE online registration system for vaccinations of those aged between 65 and 69 will open tomorrow morning. So you will be, he's saying, from tomorrow, you'll be able to register to book your vaccination using your air code and your PPS number. Now, though, I'm joined on the line by Phil Nihay, General Secretary of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
We have some news just reaching us this morning from the Health Information and Quality Authority. It's recommending a series of measures to encourage COVID-19 vaccination uptake among health staff, including mandatory vaccination as a last resort to be considered. Now, the advice to NPHET says that another option would be the redeployment of staff, so moving staff who do not wish to be vaccinated to lower risk areas. What's your reaction to this?
Yeah, we haven't seen that particular piece, but it's consistent with the meetings we're having with the HSE. There isn't any indication that mandatory vaccine would help a situation. Currently, the majority of healthcare workers are getting vaccinated. There are a big concern now in respect of people who have had first dose AstraZeneca are waiting for the second. So we've corresponded with the chief clinical officer last evening, asking him a series of questions that our members have raised with us directly. And there is a concern, for example, in respect of whether there is a gender issue here, whether more women are, and from the media reports and the reports we've seen, it would appear that the incidences of low platelets and clotting is higher in women.
And now, did you get a response to that? I know you only sent it in last night, but anything back?
No, not yet, but we're meeting with the HSE at 12 o'clock today, so obviously we'll be raising all of these issues. There is concern among our student members.
Can I just deal with the AstraZeneca situation first? Because you have people who have had the first dose and now they're asking questions about whether they should take the second dose. They're concerned.
Yeah, I think it's like the general question, but I suppose if you're in the front line and you're working with COVID-positive patients all of the time, you have a knowledge of what side effects would happen normally. So I think they have specific questions which we've posed, and they're expecting to get those answered. But in addition, no more than the general population, people who've had the first dose are saying, "Well, what advice are you giving me now? I'm awaiting the second. Can I take a different vaccine? Is that going to be available to me?" And most of the vaccines to date have been. About 150,000 healthcare workers have had AstraZeneca. And
But NIAC advice was very clear on this on Monday, wasn't it? If you've had the first dose and if after 7 to 12 days you've had no reaction, then you should go on and have the second dose.
They're not saying that to age specific. And that's, again, at 12 o'clock today, we're getting specific instruction for our healthcare workers on that issue. And then that causes, I suppose, follow-on questions in respect of people with underlying health conditions and what risk assessment is going to take place. We had an issue last week where student nurses, for example, were told that if they refused to take the vaccine, that they could not continue with their clinical placement. These are the unpaid student first, second and third years. That has been that directive has been removed, and they're now being told that they can continue to attend. So there's a lot of, I suppose, issues that arise from that. And a lot of issues that we expect to have, particularly student nurses who were in the workplace, unprotected, wearing PPE, unpaid, and all of a sudden they're being told that's okay if the issue was that we couldn't supply a vaccine to you, but if you refuse a vaccine, we'll stop your training. It just seems a little bit one-sided. Mm-hmm. So there's a real issue there for that particular cohort. The bigger issue, I think, overall on this topic is that most certainly the vaccine is the issue that will bring the most hope to everybody. But also, our health service simply can't cope with the fourth wave.
And we've been told, haven't we? Clearly, NPHET has said, you know, there is a strong possibility of a fourth wave if the country opens up very quickly. One of the key metrics on that, of course, is the vaccination rollout. So that is a risk that has been outlined clearly.
Yes, and I think I don't have to tell people this because everybody knows this. The reason that Ireland has taken specific approaches is because our health service can't cope. Our health service was underfunded for many years, and we have done a very good job considering the resources that have been available to us during this pandemic. We have a very low rate of death from COVID-19, and we have worked really hard. Our frontline workers have done extraordinary work. But we had a meeting with the HSE yesterday, and we asked the question about reopening for non-COVID services. They confirmed to us that the level of long COVID among our members, health nurses, midwives, is high. The level of exhaustion is a worrying feature for them. We know this anyway. Plus, we also now have a real problem in recruitment. Many of our nurses come from countries like the Philippines and India, and that has been delayed because of the travel restrictions generally throughout the pandemic. But also, we have a real issue now with having to provide, our public health nurses, for example, are providing services in screening, they're providing vaccination clinic staffing, but there aren't extra public health nurses.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that last year we didn't train sufficient numbers, the year before we didn't train sufficient numbers. We've been lagging behind the numbers we should have been training for years.
Okay.
So everybody's under pressure. The point is the idea that we would be able to provide COVID and non-COVID services at the same time will result in a collapsing of those that work in the health service, because it simply is not humanly possible or humanly possible to continue at the pace they've been going at. And there aren't any reprieves. And the HSE have advised that they're concerned about the amount of deferred annual leave that they've asked people to take. They're now getting concerned about that.
Phil Nihay, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. We move now to Dr. Cliona Nicali, consultant in infectious diseases at St. James's Hospital. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining us this morning. I don't know if you heard me saying there that Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, has confirmed that one of the issues they'll be looking at is spacing out the Pfizer vaccine. Do you think that that is a good call, that it's something worth considering?
I think all options are worth considering, and it is difficult to make these decisions because new evidence, new data is coming out all the time, and there's very little data on changing the spacing or using, you know, AstraZeneca for your first dose and something else for your second dose. So, you know, NIAC and the EMA and everybody who's involved in these decisions are having to make their best guesses based on what's available. But I think, you know, this pandemic has shown us the importance of having backup plans and considering all the options, because often the plan that we have thought we can go with, as has happened now again, doesn't work out and we have to go back and decide what we're going to do next.
You know, the strategy was to bank vaccines so that you'd have them there ready for when somebody needed their second dose. Do you think we should abandon that plan now, just get them all out there?
I think it's probably safer to abandon that now, because I presume that the supply chains that go into making those vaccines, you know, manufacturing has been underway for probably about 6 months now, so that those supply chains for all the things that need to be available to make the vaccines are stronger. And I think that, you know, there's probably Pfizer and Moderna are able to give with much more certainty commitments to deliver a certain amount of vaccines. So I think that it's definitely worth considering whether or not we're happy enough with the supply chain that we can go ahead and use those second doses that we've held in reserve, use them as first doses on the assumption that we'll get second doses.
The minister also said this morning that this online registration portal will be open tomorrow for those aged between 65 and 69 to register for their vaccination using their PPS number and their error code, which sounds very efficient. But the vaccine that they will be offered is AstraZeneca. And we're getting so many messages from people yesterday and today who are really worried about taking this. You know, they're saying to us, we're between 60 and 69. We are the only ones who are being considered eligible for AstraZeneca.
So I was really encouraged by listening to the interview, the kind of people on the street that you had earlier in the show, and listening. I think people are really well informed about vaccines and medicines in general, and that there is always, you know, it's always weighing up the risks of taking the vaccine compared to the risks of not taking it. And I think we are being very cautious. The risks of these very rare type of side effects that people are getting with AstraZeneca and potentially with Johnson & Johnson are extremely rare, and they are, you know, in younger, predominantly women. So I think, and 65 to 69 year olds are in an age bracket where a lot of people get very unwell with COVID. So I think it's an absolutely reasonable strategy. And if I myself was in that age group and being offered AstraZeneca, I would absolutely take it. You know, we're not computers and we're not always logical, but I think, you know, on very, very rare side effects, we're restricting AstraZeneca use. So the fact that we're saying go ahead in 65 to 69 year olds, that decision has been made with an abundance of caution.
Too much caution?
It's so hard to know, isn't it? Because you're trying to weigh up one thing against another. And, you know, there is a significant mortality with these very, very, very rare blood clots that we're seeing with AstraZeneca. You know, one in five people who get them die. And they're in young people who weren't particularly at high risk of severe COVID. So in that age group, it's a very different risk scenario. But for older age groups where there's much higher risk of severe illness with COVID, absolutely, I think we're safe to go ahead.
I have some listener questions coming in for you. Is there a connection between women who are on the pill and getting clots from the vaccine, from AstraZeneca?
Not that I have seen. So there are connections between pills and clots, but that's a different type of clot. That's clots in usually in the leg. They're called deep venous thromboses. They're much, much more common. People with COVID tend to get them a lot. People who are immobile in bed and the pill and smoking increase that risk. The clots that we're seeing with AstraZeneca are a very rare, very particular type of clot that happens in the blood vessels around, in the veins, in the brain or in going into the spleen, and that are associated with the platelets. That's the bit of your blood that clots becoming activated and all clumping together. It's a very particular type of clot and it's different to the one that we see with the pill.
Okay, Cliath and Nikhil, if you could stay with us because I want to bring in the CEO of IBEC, Danny McCoy. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning.
Last night, the CEO of Greencore and the brother of the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Patrick Coveney, tweeted, "Hard to overstate the incompetence and lack of foresight here. Ireland is now officially shut off from US and most of EU with little hope of being able to safely source the massive levels of hotel prison capacity to sustain mandatory hotel quarantine policy." Do you agree with that?
I agree with the sentiment, definitely. Patrick is right. We need to distinguish some of the things that are happening here. The vaccine rollout is very difficult because of the real-time changes and evidence becoming available quickly. And so I have great sympathy for the rollout and aspects of that. I wonder about the term abundance of caution. We need appropriate caution. If that's the appropriate caution, then that's fine. But to go beyond that, we can raise an issue. Hotel quarantine is a very different issue. There was plenty of time to think this through and think through what the benefits, perceived benefits, would be of the quarantine to try and stop the variants coming into the economy. But not enough was considered on the damage that's done by hotel quarantine, both to people's lives, but critically, from my point of view, to our business system, because the economic life and the brand of Ireland being open for business and ultimately out of sequence with other jurisdictions, it required coordination. And it's nonsensical to go for half a zero COVID strategy when we haven't got coordination on the island. So the dubious benefits from quarantine, if they could have been achieved, need to be set aside against the costs. And the costs are quite significant. At Patrick's point, lack of foresight about adding on really significant and large-scale strategic interests with lots of people in it, the US, France and Italy, did lack foresight. It does raise issues about competence.
Yeah, but they have a problem in those countries, don't they, with the variants, and we don't know how those variants respond to vaccination.
We don't care, and neither do they, and it should be coordinated. Because we're an island, is put forward a la New Zealand, there's a really distinct difference. We're not coordinated with Northern Ireland. We're not coordinated with Britain.
And just how
if
much...
If we're coordinated, it might make sense.
Can I just ask you...
The cost, the benefit.
We're not supposed to have any non-essential travel happening. So just how disruptive is hotel quarantine for business?
Yeah, because if you look at the models we have, and if you look at the pharmaceutical business we have here, the medical, the technology, these all require subject matter experts to come in. But also Irish people provide those services internationally in Italy and France in terms of software, in terms of these factories that are critical and essential. And so right now, this is a blanket message that's gone out that if you're going to be traveling into Ireland, it's 14 days. And it's the imagery around this. There should have been foresight about it's not just a question of adding on countries when you hadn't that system in place. We've known about the zero COVID type strategy if we wanted to pursue it. We didn't actually test that out in terms of its costs and benefits. I'd be dubious about its practicality given the all-island dimension here without coordination. But this was certainly avoidable. And I spoke about this on your show 2 weeks ago. We're all, particularly since the US being put on the list, the amount of queries are coming in from senior executives as to what's going on in Ireland, how are we going to actually get critical people into critical places with this 14 days. And also the issues around the sensitivity of the people being able to work from those hotels during those 14 days is dubious as well in terms of security of the Wi-Fi systems, etc., just as a small practical example.
All right.
And then you layer in what's happening, individuals' lives are being thrown up and down. Erasmus students are in. What about apprenticeships that are actually making their living in Holland and Italy as well, young people who might want to come back? What's the difference between a student in a prestigious university versus somebody working in an industry or a factory?
Can I bring Cliann and Callaghan on this? I mean, do you think, given that we see this capacity issue, before we even bring on the extra 16 countries that will be on the quarantine list from tomorrow morning, I mean, does it show that it's just not workable to hotel quarantine this many people in this country?
I don't think so. I mean, there's a lot of empty hotel rooms that are available. So we have the structural capacity, and we have staff in the hospitality industry who are on pandemic unemployment payment. So this is potentially a way to return them to employment. So, I mean, we do have the physical and the human power capacity to do it. It's just a question of getting that organised.
Okay,
and what cost and what damage to the society through the economic model has that actually been assessed?
Well, I suppose we need to weigh that up against the potential cost and damage associated
with
the variants.
When is it going to be weighed up in real time?
But it is being weighed up against the variants of concern coming in. I think we saw, you know, the second and third waves of COVID being seeded by travel. Being seeded by travel and the economic impact of the second and third waves of COVID have been massive. So, you know, it's not a decision in which there is no economic impact to making the wrong decision either direction.
That's true. But that should have been weighed up in terms of an impact assessment. That should have been done well in advance, as opposed to just throwing countries onto the list without actually having the capacity to be able to absorb it or work out what the implications of it were. And if all of this actually worked, as in the benefit of keeping variants out, then it would be worth doing potentially. But we know we've got an open island, the top of the island, in an uncoordinated way. So there's no guarantee of keeping these variants out.
I suppose what COVID and the pandemic response has told us is that aiming for perfection often is the worst option. So you need to go with the best that you can in as many different ways and as many different layers as possible. And you can't rely on a single element of your response solving the problem. You need to use every tool at your disposal to try and address
the cost.
All right.
Cost is the issue.
Danny, I want to bring in Eoghan Corey, editor of Air and Travel magazine. Good morning to you, Eoghan.
Good morning, Sarah.
The Minister for Health has said that airlines will be asked not to let passengers on board from these high-risk countries if they don't have hotel quarantine bookings. So it'll be up to the airlines to do this. Are they currently letting anyone on at the moment?
And that's already happening, Claire. You will not get on a connection flight from... Most of what we're talking about is coming from Asia here, India, Pakistan, major markets flying to Ireland. You go to your Emirates desk and you haven't got anything booked. And there's quite a few people don't realise Ireland is doing this because it's such a unique thing to do. We're the only country doing this. So they are not being let on board. So
that
it's interesting
right.
to hear what...
That can't be right, because then we wouldn't have any walk-ins.
Well, it's interesting to hear what Stephen Donnelly said yesterday evening. Obviously, his access to information that the aviation industry wouldn't have from the Department of Justice, which is what Jack alluded to. It's being shown up in the forms that people fill. What could be happening is that we have self-connectors. And self-connection is a huge part of international aviation. Irish people do it. They take one flight to a city, then get on another flight from that city, and people travelling around the world have got used to it. And airlines don't like it, actually. They like everybody to go through a big hub like Paris or Amsterdam and Frankfurt and stay on the same airline. That would tend to happen more with the major Asian hubs, of which all of whom are on the red list now. They would include Doha, Abu Dhabi, Dubai and Amsterdam. What can be happening is two things could be happening, could be alluded to by the minister last night. One is the self-connector coming from one of the red list countries, which, as you say, has been expanded to include huge markets. I mean, until now, we didn't have very, very big inbound markets on it. And the second thing, which is very important as well, is people who manage to get on board a flight without a PCR test, they are also going to count as a walk-in. There's no real way around that. They also should not be let on board, but it's being policed by people at check-in desks at European airports. And even in the days when you weren't allowed to fly without the proper visa into Ireland, you'd always have a small number of people getting through.
So do you expect then, or do you accept that it is up to the airlines to police this? I mean, they shouldn't be letting people on board who don't have a valid PCR test.
there is incredulity in the aviation industry that this is, they are being held up as the villains in this because they are doing that. They are policing it.
But it's in their interest to police it.
That's what I said. There's incredulity. They are doing it. People were turned away because this, you know, there is a. It's so unusual for a European country to do what we're doing. People have turned up at airports. People have turned up at airports expecting it not to apply to them because they're vaccinated. Mm-hmm. People have expected it not to apply from them because they've come from countries with very high levels of vaccination. Dubai, United Arab Emirates would be. And we saw people landing in Dublin Airport that were absolutely incredulous that they were expected to do mandatory hotel quarantine.
A listener asks Owen, or makes the point rather, if someone arrives from a country on the list without a hotel booking, the airline should be obliged to fly them straight back out again.
Interestingly enough, that's what applies if you arrive without a visa. And that that legislation's already in place. But when you're, what I'm being told by the aviators is it's not happening through the big hubs. If it is somebody arriving from a red list country, they've probably come from somewhere like Lisbon or Frankfurt or Paris. And then you have the big question is, how do they get back? How does an airline fly them back to a red list country when another non-Irish airline has flown them to that hub?
Okay.
Self-connecting is pretty normal in the industry and pretty normal in world travel. And to try and roll back the clock and pretend that it hasn't come in to existence is going to be very, very difficult for anyone.
Owen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you also
to
Danny McCoy and Cliannini Callig. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.